Oh, open your Bibles to Isaiah 14. Start there because we didn't finish the chapter. Get them open, and then I want you to take a look at this
Well, keep going.
outline. We've got the blue highlights. I want you to open to you got your Bibles open to chapter 14. I want you to open here to this and look at the far right column. It says Babylon and Philistia, Moab, Damascus, Cush, Egypt, desert nations, Jerusalem, Tyre. Give me your thoughts about why something like that would be. I mean, why these chapters? Aren't we talking about God establishing a his new mountain? The mountain of the house of the Lord will be raised up above the mountains, chapter 2, in the last days. So why are we concerned about Damascus, for example, or Egypt, or the desert nations? Why are we concerned about these various countries?
Neighbor.
Pardon?
They're neighbors.
They are neighbors, okay?
Rod.
Them on the Exodus, a lot of them.
Some of them they conquered on the Exodus. One, Egypt they left. Damascus they didn't touch. But some of them, yeah. Cush, of course, is right there next to Egypt.
That's my
All of them, and take what Candy said and what Linda said. All of them are going to be brushed with this scourge that's coming through for Jerusalem. God is. As we saw in chapter 10, God was going to use Assyria to cut down Israel. And then he was going to turn his, once he's finished with Israel, he was going to turn his attention to Assyria. And these nations would all be impacted by that invasion because it wasn't a, like we said, it was not a laser strike, it was a shotgun blast. Anything in our way, we are harvesting. It was like a locust invasion, just eat everything along the way. All these nations would be impacted by the Assyrian and Babylonian invasion. And so we call attention to that because last week we looked at Babylon and the rise and fall of Babylon. We left off with actually, an interesting little piece. After talking about Babylon for a chapter and a half, he turned around and mentioned Assyria. Yeah, Assyria was the power that was at the time that Isaiah wrote. Babylon didn't come along for another 100 years later. Wasn't a power at the time. So he mentions Assyria, and then he starts into the surrounding nations. Now, Babylon would take care of Assyria, and both Assyria and Babylon would be impacting these nations. But primarily, we're looking at the Babylonian invasion, primarily. So, let's go back to chapter 14, and it was just this will be just a little bit of overlap. And we're going to start in verse 24, 14:24. Yahweh of hosts has sworn, saying, "Surely, just as I have intended, so it has happened, and just as I have planned, so it will stand." Now, remember, we pointed out that there was both past tense and future tense in here. As I planned, it did happen. As I planned, it will stand. And to break Assyria in my land. Now we saw that back in chapter 10, didn't we? That he would take care of Assyria after Assyria had cut down his forest for him. And I will trample him on my mountains. Then his yoke will be removed from them and his burden removed from their shoulder. Now, when did God break Assyria? Well, let me start. This prophecy here probably could be dated somewhere around 726 BC. BC. Okay. Now, when your BC is like below zero, and the smaller the number, the closer you are to zero. So 726 BC is 726 years before the zero. When did he break Assyria in the land? No.
I need to sit with Babylon too.
Babylon took, that's when Babylon destroyed the temple, 586. Babylon took the first wave of captives in 606.
So I was done 70 years before that.
722.
No, not that far.
Rachel says
715.
Go ahead.
715.
Yeah, about 715. No. 615.
722.
722 is when Assyria captured Israel. But when did God break the Assyria? 100 years later. It's when
612.
Nebuchadnezzar conquered them somewhere around Carchemish and between 615 and 609 BC. So 100, 111 to 120 years after Assyria did what they did to Israel, God broke Assyria in his land. So these are not just the next day. When Isaiah wrote this, it was going to be 100 years before God broke Assyria. But you might say, is that true? Or did God break Assyria the night that 185,000 of their soldiers died? We'll get that in chapters 38 and 39 when the Assyrian was invading, and Hezekiah prayed about it, and God killed 185,000 of their soldiers one night in the land. And that may be where he broke them, but they didn't fall to Nebuchadnezzar for 100 years after that. All right. So, but key to all this is what I have said in the past has taken place, and what I have said will take place. Those are, as I pointed out last week, in chapters 40 through 44, that was the prime test that God wanted his people to put any so-called God to, put them to this test. Has what they said about the past come to pass, and will they make some predictions about the future by which you can test them? And then he stepped up and said, I will. Everything I've said so far has come to pass. And by the way, there's a guy named Cyrus. He'll restore my temple 200 years from now. So God just reached out and gave himself credentials. But you see it right here. See, in verse 24, just as I have intended, so it has happened. And just as I have planned, so it will stand. That's the mark of a God you can trust. Predictions from the past have taken place and account for what's happened. Predictions now will take place and can be the essence of. By the way, Linda, this is what this is. When you see fulfilled prophecy, you can say that was God speaking through that man. So when Cyrus actually did do what Isaiah said he would do, we can say, well, that was God speaking through Isaiah, because he couldn't have known that without that. Anyway, pushing on, pushing on. Now, one of the things that, and I pointed out all these nations, see, Philistia here at the end of 14, Moab in chapters 15 and 16, Damascus in 17, Cush in 18, Egypt in 19 and 20, the various desert nations in chapter 21, Jerusalem herself in 22, and then Tyre in chapter 23. All these were going to be impacted by the encroaching army, primarily Babylon, like I said. But every one of these had something that they might pin their future on that would fail. And every one of these, we're going to see a call to come to that mountain that God raised up and said he would raise up in chapter 2. Every one of these is going to have some reference to don't depend upon this, depend upon Zion. Every one of these. So I give you that in advance just because it's kind of exciting to me, because these are all Gentile nations. And he's saying to the Gentiles, you can come to Zion and find the rescue or the comfort or the peace or the protection or the justice that you've been looking for, that you haven't gotten. I look at our world today, our chaotic world, and the anger that is fomenting in the hearts of so many, just anger. And they're not at peace. And they're thumbing their nose at the very thing that could give them peace, and that is a recognition of the rule of God in their lives. And so that's what this section is going to be about. That's why I'm really excited about it. Now, starting in verse 28. In the year that King Ahaz died, this oracle came. Do not rejoice, O Philistia, all of you, because the rod that struck you is broken. For from the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. And those who are most helpless will eat, and the needy will lie down in security. I will destroy your root with famine, and will kill it, and it will kill off your survivors. Wail, O gate, cry, O city, melt away, O Philistia, all of you. For smoke comes from the north, and there is no straggler in his ranks. How then will one answer the messengers of the nation? That Yahweh has founded Zion, and the afflicted of his people will seek refuge in it. Any thoughts on that? I mean, I'm excited about what I just read there, but I've got some thoughts in my mind I want to share with you, but I want to hear yours first. Any thoughts? Any online thoughts?
Yeah, I had a...
Yeah, go, Michael.
Well, especially the last part. I was studying this earlier and wanted to get with you on it now that you brought it up, about Yahweh founded Zion. The founded is more or less an establishing, and this is, Zion has always been a challenge to understand because it's for a mountain as well as a covenant people, but it's dealing with the relationship of covenant relationship, isn't it? The establishment of that. Of his God and his people, their God and his people.
I think you're onto something there. That Zion represents the spiritual relationship between God and his people, and I don't necessarily say the covenant aspect of it because that it would be there, but it's more like this is where God and his people are. This is the house. The mountain of God, the Zion of God, the place where God is with his people. Now, he's with them because of the covenant relationship, but it's more focused on this is the place of God's protection and care. Okay? So now, go back to verse 29. See, now, this is the year that King Ahaz died was the year that King Hezekiah became king. So you can go back in Kings or Chronicles and see that. And that's about the date that Alan gave earlier, about 715, when Hezekiah became king or when Ahaz died. And the message is, don't rejoice, Philistia, because the rod that struck you is broken. Chapter 10, Isaiah, Assyria is what? The rod of God's indignation.
Yeah,
Acts, but earlier it says the rod, in whose hand is my indignation. And so that rod which was striking them now is broken. Woo! We're free! So, and this takes me back, I don't know, it's, some of you, this half the room, maybe not this half the room, will remember the name Nikita Khrushchev. You remember him? He took his shoe off and he's pounding there at the UN and says, "We will bury you." And I was so excited when the man died. Like, now we're free. What happened when Khrushchev died? The next in line. The next in line. What happens when a shark loses its tooth? The next in line. So when this despot that is making life miserable for you passes away, that's not the answer to your peace. Because look what it says. For from the serpent's root, a viper will come out, and its root will be a flying serpent. So you got rid of a bad one, you're going to get a worse one. Now, who is the rod that struck you? I think it's talking about Assyria. Yeah. I don't think one commentator says, well, Israel was the major foe of Philistia. Yeah, maybe they were at each other, but I don't think that was the scourge that came through. And when Philistia, see, because in verse, where was it? In verse 25, was it to bring the Assyria in my land? When Assyria was broken, okay, we're out from under. No, you're not. Something worse is coming. Something worse is coming. Babylon, and then Medo-Persia, and then Macedonia, and ultimately Rome. Something worse is coming. And so there's always going to be a despot. I mean, in our lifetime, there have been guys like Pol Pot, and I guess Hitler was a little before me, but pardon?
Could not be.
Yeah, more on Daffy, that guy, Gaddafi. What was that guy that Bush was after? Hussein?
Was about Hussein.
Saddam, he said. Saddam Hussein. Saddam did that to irritate him. There's always going to be the next tyrant, the next one in line. The nature abhors a vacuum, and even if it's a power vacuum, if somebody's going to suck into it who doesn't fear God, doesn't care about people. Your peace is not going to be when the tyrant collapses. What did he say? Yahweh has founded Zion. You want peace in your life? Don't look for political solutions. Don't look for military solutions. Look to Zion. See, and I think that's the message that we have here. Any thoughts on this little section about Philistia?
No, nothing that I read ahead, and it's just kind of the, then he chose. So the next, all of these other nations that are on your list here, it shows there's going to be judgment, but I'm going to call you into Zion.
Yeah, but each one of these has something that they put their confidence in. And so it's like we're just going to go around the block here and isolate that thing that you might think, if this only were true, I'd have peace. No, it doesn't work that way. Come to Zion.
So the following chapters all point to these verses, though.
Yeah. So why don't we just skip on then and start in chapter 23? Oh, 24.
Okay.
No, no, there's really some good stuff in here. So anything else on chapter 14?
Rod.
All right. Let me see where I am.
Rod.
Yes. Yeah.
The great thing that I was looking at and thinking about is we don't have it here. We just got all one book, but yet this was written over years and years in probably segmented oracles or laments or whatever you want to call it to the people before certain events were taking place. Is that right?
Yeah, you can't write, well, God could, but you don't really write history before it happens. And but yeah, so we got prophecies here of Isaiah that cover the span of his prophetic work, which was extensive, like his lifetime. But the message is still the same. Come to Zion. Tell the messengers from the nations that God has established Zion. And so you want peace, it's not going to be with the collapse of the tyrant, it's going to be in Zion. And we'll see here with Moab, we're going to have, and as we go through here, I handed out to the audience this map, and I also sent it to everybody via email. And like I said, in chapters 15 and 16, there are 12 to 14, maybe even more, different cities mentioned. And so I want to share that with you. I went and found them all. And I didn't print my copy for you because I thought maybe you'd want to do it yourself about where these places are. But before I will send you the address to that map. I mean, it's amazing. I'm glad I discovered it. Linda, you had a question.
Oh, like an observation. So he's, God is talking to the Gentiles, saying, come to Zion.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's why I got so excited. This is an invitation to me. Now, when we get to chapter 49, he's going to say to Messiah, I'm talking to Messiah before Messiah is born, that it's too small a thing that you be my servant to raise up Israel and Judah. I'm also going to make you a light to the Gentiles. So God's desire to bring Gentiles into Zion has been from the beginning, but it's really prominent here in the book of Isaiah. Okay, chapter 15. What do you know about Moab? Now, I don't mean Moab, Utah.
Son, slap, grandson.
I am my own grandpa. Well, Lot's son by his daughter. Remember how the daughters got, they got him drunk and said, nobody's going to want us, and we want to have children, so we use our dad.
Listen, God, I understood that they actually thought all humans, like that they were.
Well, that's irrelevant. It's just, where did Moab come from? They came from Lot through an incestuous relationship with his daughter. Now, what was the other one? Moab and Ammon. Two related to Israel, but enemies of Israel. Okay, so here is Moab. Where is Moab? Look on your map, you'll see it. On the east side of the Dead Sea. Sometimes we say it goes all the way up to the top of the Dead Sea. Sometimes we say the north border is the Arnon River, which comes in midsection. Okay, but that area, east of the Dead Sea, we have Moab and Ammon, the two sons of Lot. And sometimes they were fierce enemies, and sometimes they were they had a connection. I'll talk about the connection first. The connection is, of course, they were Abraham's nephews, tribes, right? Lot was Abraham's nephew, and these two tribes came from Lot. And so they had familial connection, but they also had a really deep connection to the king of Judah, right? To the kingly line of Judah. Why do I say that? Ruth. Ruth was a Moabitess. She married Moab, or not Moab, Boaz. Boaz. Boaz had a son, and that son had Jesse. Jesse had David. So David, when he was fleeing from Saul, sent his parents into Moab for protection. And so there was a kind of a friendliness, but they were also hostile. When Judah came out of Egypt, and they wanted to pass through on the king's highway to get up to the plains opposite Jericho so they could go on in. And the king of Moab, hired, what was that guy's name? Balaam. Hired Balaam to curse them. And so try to bring a curse on. And when Balaam failed, Balaam counseled, said, I can't curse him, but here's what you can do. You can send your pretty priestesses into the men there, and they'll start worshiping your gods with that kind of sacrifice. And so try to subvert them so that God would curse them. And under the judges, there was a, pardon?
First, Israelites, was that it? First,
Balaam, Balak, the king of Moab, wanted Balaam to curse Israel. God wouldn't let him. Three times he pronounced a blessing. So Balak dismissed Balaam. But later, Balaam wanted that money. He wanted that money. So he said, if you send your God's priestesses among the Israelites, they'll start profaning God, and God himself will bring a curse upon them. And so that's what they did. And then there was, during the times of the judges, there was a king. You remember, what was his name? Eglon. Eglon, king of, I mean, they're really fat guy. So fat that when the left-handed judge skewered him with a saber, it went all the way in, and the fat of his belly just covered up the half of the sword. Anyway, they were aggressive toward Israel. So sometimes Moab was an enemy, sometimes they were a friend, but they were a profane nation, a very rich agriculturally, as we'll see in the reading. Now, any thoughts about just Moab? I don't know that I'll go into this kind of detail with all of them, but Moab was a relative. The oracle, the word oracle means burden. It means the burden, God's burden upon Moab. Surely in a night, Ar of Moab is devastated ruin. Surely in a night, Ker of Moab is devastated ruin. They have gone up to the temple and to Dibon, to the high places, to weep. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba. Everyone's head is bald, every beard is cut off. In their streets, they have girded themselves with sackcloth. On their housetops and in their squares, everyone is wailing, dissolved in tears. Heshbon and Eleala also cry out. Their voice is heard all the way to Jahaz. Therefore, the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles within him. My heart cries out for Moab. His fugitives are as far as Zoar and Eglath-Shelishiah, where they go up the ascent of Luhith, weeping. Surely on the road to Horonaim, they raise a cry of distress over ruin, for the waters of Nimrim are desolate. Surely the grass is withered, the tender grass dried out. There is no green thing. Therefore, the abundance they have acquired and stored up, they carry off over the brook of Arabim. For the cry of distress has gone around the territory of Moab. Its wail goes as far as Eglaim, and its wailing even to Beer Elim, for the waters of Dimon are full of blood. Surely I will bring added woes upon Dimon, a lion upon the fugitives of Moab and the remnant of the land. Do you see how many different villages and cities are mentioned in there? Now, I put it upon you to just look these up and see where they are. But on your map, you have Jazer is up at the very top center of the map. It's probably right where the green and brown go under the edge of the border of the map. And then Eglaim is down at the bottom of the Dead Sea. Jahaz is for middle of the Dead Sea, but far west, far east. Most of the cities are along the coast of the Dead Sea, but some are on the King's Highway, which is that kind of that little grayish line that goes north and south, the King's Highway. The point is, they're all over the map. Ar, for example, the Ar of Moab is right at the mouth of the Arnon River, which is enters the Dead Sea right in the middle of it. And so it's right there. And Zoar is you remember Zoar from your Genesis stories? That's where Lot fled to, the south end of the Dead Sea. Okay? And so, but the picture, and he said, where I saw it in here as we were reading, that it oh, I don't see it right now. But it was all the villages everywhere. Everyone is wailing, it says into verse 3, but that's not the place I was thinking of. The idea is every village throughout the there it is in verse 8. The cry of distress has gone around the territory of Moab. And so he paints a picture of everything, big city, little city. When I lived in the Midwest, there were towns about every 10 miles in any direction, north, south, east, or west. And these were gathering spots for the produce that was the corn or the wheat that was grown. They would bring them to a central spot so they could be distributed. But you go further north, and there were some big cities in Illinois. But there was these little cities that were useful for the gathering of the produce. And some of these villages are, that's what they're going to be, just produce gatherers. Some of them are going to be big cities and capital cities. It'd be kind of like if we were saying, you know, it's Seattle is just going to be a heap of ruins. In Tacoma, we're crying over what happened in the streets of Tacoma. And the apple orchards of Yakima have been devastated. See, we just talk about what it means to that particular location and how, and that's what he's doing here. That's what he's doing here. What would you suppose would be the major economy of Moab? Let's keep reading. But I'm going to skip over 1 through 5, and I'm going to pick up verse 6, and you'll see why in a minute. We have heard of the pride of Moab, an excessive pride. They're proud of something. Now, when I lived in Idaho, they were pretty proud of their potatoes. Yakima might be proud of its apples, its apple orchards, or Wenatchee. Yakima also has a lot of peaches. Boy, they got good peaches. And so excessive pride, arrogance, pride, fury, his idle boasts are false. Therefore, Moab shall wail. Everyone of Moab shall wail. You shall moan for the raisin cakes of Kir-Hareseth. What's a raisin cake? What's a raisin?
Right.
It's a dried grape. Now you take those and press them into, you know, Indians used to make a thing called what, pemmican? Just fruit and nuts and meat just dried up. Pardon? Well, that's fine. But you understand the idea of packing the dried fruit together so you have it and you can nuke me, you know, like jerky or whatever.
Also, you can transport it.
As the weight is down. But so they would do that. See, therefore Moab shall wail. The fields, it says here of verse 8, the fields of Heshbon have withered, the vines of Sibmah, the lords of the nations have trampled down its choice clusters, which have reached as far as Jazer. Wandered to the deserts, its tendrils spread themselves out and passed over the sea. Well, there's only one sea you can associate with Moab, isn't there? The Dead Sea. So Moab was sending whatever grows on a vine across the sea. They were, what would you say? They were sending their produce to Jerusalem, to the Judean. And that was their trade. That was their abundance. And we talked about their where was it that he mentioned their fortune, their money. Anyway, the lords of the nations have trampled them down. Verse 9, therefore I will weep bitterly for Jazer, for the vine of Sibma. I will drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Elealeh, for the sprouting, a shouting over your summer fruits and your harvest have fallen away. Now, what's a shout over our summer fruits? Now, the summer fruits would be grapes, figs, things like that. What's the shout over them? The joy of harvest, the excitement of harvest. He says, gone. It's gone. And gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field. The vineyards, in the vineyards also, there will be no cries of joy or jubilant shouting. No treader treads out wine in the presses. I have made the shouting to cease. But here's a land whose economy depended upon their abundant fruit. And they were able to export it to others. And he says, your productivity is gone. But there's something else that we saw in chapter 14, 15, and I didn't call your attention to it. Let me go back in verse 2. They have gone up to the temple to Dibon, to the high places to weep. What's going on there? Pardon?
Where they were have offers and stuff.
That's where they're calling upon their false gods for help. It's where they're calling upon their false, and they're getting nothing. See, they're getting nothing. So come back here to chapter 16 again, verse 11. Therefore, my heart intones like a harp for Moab, and my inner feelings for Kirhareseth. So it'll come about. When Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself upon his high place and comes to his sanctuary to pray, that he will not prevail. So disaster's coming upon him. It's spread about the entire nation. And there's tears and crying and weeping and going to a false god. He presents himself, wearies himself upon his high place. Think about that. Wearies himself upon his high place. Do you remember the contest on Mount Carmel? How the prophets of Baal, how many of them were there? 400, and even more than that, actually, because they were them and the others. And they danced and they pranced and they gashed themselves in blood, trying to get fire to come down from heaven. They wearied themselves calling upon their God, and it didn't work. And so all we see here is he wearies himself upon his high place to no avail. To no avail. All right. Now, verse 13. This is the word which Yahweh spoke earlier concerning Moab. Now you go back to the end of chapter 14, the what I said came to place, and what I say will take place. And you got it going both ways. So this is what I'm saying now, but earlier I said this. Within 3 years, as a hired man would count them, the glory of Moab will be degraded along with all great population, and remnant will be very small, impotent. So I'm going to bring her down, God said 3 years ago. Now he's saying that the entire agricultural economy is going to be destroyed. And he's saying it's such that it's dried up. But in the middle of 15 and this last half of 16 becomes 16, 1 through 5. Let's close out with that. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land. I'm going to stop there and ask you what you think that is. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land. Any thoughts? Anybody? Send the lamb. What's a lamb all about?
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice. Sacrifice, okay? Send the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah by the way of the wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. So what should Moab, the Moabites do? What should they do when they see this great tragedy coming upon them? Offer a sacrifice to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. Chapter 2, in the last days, the mountain of the house of Yahweh will be lifted up as the chief of the mountains. Okay? Then, like fleeing birds or scattered nestlings, the daughters of Moab will be at the fords of the Ain. Did I read that right? The fords, not the Chevys, not the Oldsmobiles. First of all, what's the Arnon? The fords of the Arnon.
That river right in the middle.
That's that river right in the middle that enters the Dead Sea, right square in the middle of the Dead Sea. It's coming down. By the way, Dead Sea is over 1,000 feet below sea level. I think it's about 1,400, but I don't remember. It's below sea level, which means what? They got mountains on both sides of it, right? And so the Arnon River is flowing downhill here on the east side of the Dead Sea, the west edge of Moab. And so we've got this river that is a tributary to the Dead Sea, but it's also a draining area of the territory of Moab. And to cross it, we got to ford the river. And so coming across the fords of the Arnon to where? The daughters of Moab will be at the fords of the Arnon. What's he saying? I think what he's saying is that they're crossing the Arnon to get to Zion, because he's called them in verse 1 to bring the lamb to Zion. And so then they're going to be like fleeing birds. So they're fleeing their country, crossing the fords of the Arnon to get to Zion. Now that's, I'm putting my thoughts in there, to get to Zion. Yeah. Give advice. Make a decision. Cast your shadow like night at high noon. Hide the outcast. Do not betray the fugitive. What's a fugitive? A runner. Yeah. We say tempest fugit. It's the Greek word, which means to fly, to run fast, to get out of here. So we got these fugitives. Don't betray us. See, we are leaving our country to come to Zion. So don't betray us. Let the outcasts of Moab stay with you. Be a hiding place to them from the destroyer. So let us find our refuge, not in the gods that can't help us, not in the economic prosperity that we've had, but let us find our protection in Zion. Bring your sacrifice to Zion and find your protection there. For the extortioner has come to an end. Destruction has ceased. Oppressors have completely disappeared from the land. Why? Because a throne will even be established in loving kindness, and a judge will sit on it in faithfulness in the tent of David. Moreover, he will seek justice and be prompt in righteousness. Justice and righteousness are the foundation of God's throne. I read that twice in the book of Psalms. Justice and righteousness, the foundation of God's throne. So here, in the midst of the invasion that leaves the land decimated, the crops failing, the economy in shatters, and gods who can't answer, there is this call, bring your sacrifice to Zion. There's a king who rules justly and in righteousness, and he will protect you. You see, it says the extortioner has come to an end. All right? In Zion, you're not going to be extorted by the leaders. In destruction has ceased. Oppressors have completely disappeared from the land. Not from the land of Moab, but from the land of Zion. Well, that's all I've got for you for tonight. We got away a little early, unless you have questions.
Question. I think there are different kinds of telephone, and you can use some of it to make one.
I don't know anything about that.
What's that?
She said, aren't there different kinds of pemmican, and didn't they use some of it to make wine? I was only using pemmican to illustrate what a raisin cake might be like, dried raisins packed together that you could carry easily and getting some nourishment on it. It would have to be rehydrated before you could make wine out of it, wouldn't it? Because wine is the breaking down of the sugars by the yeast.
In the process, selling, shipping.
Oh yeah. No, they'd make wine out of it. Yeah, sure. A lot of things they would do with the vine, the grapes. Probably wouldn't ship very many grapes as raw.
No.
Because they
Hot.
in that heat and humidity, they just wouldn't last. You'd have to convert it to a raisin cake or wine, one or the other. Yeah. That's good point.
Rod,
Yeah.
I'm interested because I was trying to remember what I was giving you an example to different people and online why to fear God because these cities, but I couldn't think of all these. I just thought of Egypt, Babylon had been destroyed, like to have the fear of God, you know, the wrong
When you say
heart.
fear, when you say fear of God, tell me what you mean by that. Fear of
Well,
God.
the realistic, I'm trying to talk to even AI entities. So why to care for creation is because God can save, he can destroy things and then does. You know, like so to fear is a realistic awareness of our insignificance.
Okay.
That's
I like that. Yeah. Yes,
to
Glenn.
We did not get the map that you referred to in the lesson.
Really? I sent it in a second email.
Oh, maybe
I
that's
sent two emails
why. All right.
because I found the map after I sent the first one.
Rachel says it's on the website now also.
She's got it on the website. So if you don't find it there, go to our website under the Isaiah study and it's there.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Linda.
Or stay with who is you?
Zion. Yeah, it's them pleading with Zion. Take us as refugees. Even in refugee, you see the word fugitive. We're fleeing from, and you've heard the term tempus fugit. Time flies. Tempus fugit, time flies. Yeah, it's the same word. Fugitive, flight. And so it's the plea, verses 3 and half of 4 is a plea of the fugitives for protection, oh, asylum. Can I use that word?
Yeah.
For asylum? That's a good word. Any other thoughts? Anything from my, pardon?
I just want to correct, we're not insignificant, but we're just small next to God. Interesting.
Just think it's interesting how so many people think that Jesus came and saved the Gentiles, and God had nothing to do with them previous to that. And he was definitely, he sent prophets to the Gentiles,
He took prophets from the Gentiles.
from the Gentiles. Job was a Gentile. I mean, so he was dealing with humanity. It's just that the Bible is focused on his relationship with
Right.
Israel. And he's always been involved with everybody in the world.
Right. And there's something very significant that Paul said in Acts 17, the times of this ignorance God winked at, but now he commands all men everywhere to repent. So before Jesus, God just overlooked or winked at the pagan mentality. I actually think, and I don't know what we're, whether we're going to recognize each other in the world beyond, but I expect that Nebuchadnezzar is there. Mean, he was a Yahweh fearer at the end. I suspect he's there, as cruel and ruthless as he was. Well, Paul was cruel and ruthless, and I expect him to be there. Yeah. Isaiah 49:6, it's too small a thing, Jesus, that you be my servant to raise up the fallen house of Israel and Judah. I will also make you a light to the Gentiles, bring them out of darkness too. So it's clear. Genesis 12:3, that in Genesis 12:3, in you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. That's before there even was a Jewish nation, right?
Which book did you say before that?
There's Isaiah 49:6 and Genesis 12:3. You can go to Zechariah 9:9, that God would take the blood out of the mouth of the Philistine and make him a remnant.
What is that from?
No, it's nine. I think it's 9:7. 9:9 is behold, your king is coming riding on a donkey, the foal, the coat, the foal of a donkey. But 9:7, I think it talks about how that God would take the blood out of the mouth of the Philistine and make him a remnant. And I think immediately of Acts 15, where this massive thing that God required of the Gentiles was to abstain from blood, to abstain from things sacrificed to idols, to abstain from fornication. And what was the third one or the fourth one? There were four. Things strangled. Yeah, things strangled because there would be blood in it. So things strangled, blood, things offered to idols, and fornication. And so Zechariah 9:7, he will take the blood out of the mouth of the Philistine, make him a remnant. Acts 15, what we require of you Gentiles to abstain from blood. That's not an accidental connection. So yeah, and there are more, Linda. You can find many, many more of where God was concerned about the Gentiles. Linda?
And verse 5, a throne will even be established in loving kindness, and a judge will sit on it. Who is the judge?
Jesus
Okay.
in the tent of David.
Yeah.
David's long gone by the time Isaiah wrote this, but they were, and the Messiah was the offspring of David from the prophet. So this and didn't we see this back in chapter 9?
Which map would you like?
Pardon? Back in chapter 9, we have the kind of the same idea. Isaiah 9. People who walk in darkness see a great light and break the yoke. No, it's chapter 11. Chapter 11. And then a shoot will be it will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. The spirit of Yahweh will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, spirit of counsel and strength, spirit of knowledge and the fear of Yahweh, and he will delight in the fear of Yahweh. He will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. And then you read this here in chapter 16, verse 4. A throne will be a throne. No, it's 11. Chapter 11, 1 through 5. Here in 16:5, a throne will even be established in loving kindness. See, he's already talked about that back in chapter 11. And it was Messiah, the child that was born, the son that was given. Any other thoughts, comments?